Today we're going to be looking at the story of Micah in Judges chapter 17 and 18. So we're missing out a bit, the story of Abimelech in chapter 9. We did a bit of minor judges. We're missing out Jephthah, missing out Samson. A few years ago, I did some plenary talks on those, but I just want to explain a little bit about how I see the Old Testament working. One of the things I've already explained is that a lot of it's showing what doesn't work to get rid of sin. So you're ready for when Jesus comes along. But also you have in the Old Testament pictures of Jesus. But Jesus is so amazing, so variegated, so manifold, so interesting that no one picture will do it. So that's why you have a king, you have a priest, you have prophets. He's prophet, priest, and king. And there's a problem with the pictures because the priests keep on dying and needing to be replaced. And so they're imperfect pictures. Now, when you look at these judges, one of the exercises you might want to do is take a character in the story of Jephthah or the story of Samson and look for similarities to Jesus and also look at contrast, because one of the ways that pictures can work is by that contrast. So, for instance, when you have Samson's self-interest when he is saving Israel and dying, killing people, that's a contrast as well as some similarity. Maybe the position is similar to Jesus. He dies like this, but he is very contrasting in moral ways, you see? And so that's the way a lot of the pictures can work. Sometimes they are mirror images as well. So I think that can be a helpful exercise to go through so that you can see. Some people worry, is this a picture of Jesus or not? Here, I think we can be helped by films, because films today often have things at the beginning that set atmosphere and context for what comes later. But we don't want to say this bit in the introduction is that bit later in the film. So what we have is the Old Testament preparing us for Jesus, some of it by setting the mood, some of it by just getting us to see little parts of the picture. So we don't have to decide either Jephthah is a picture of Jesus or not. We're able to look at it in a much richer way. Now, when we come to the end of Judges, we have what I wrongly put on the outline as two appendices. And I now regret that, because I think the problem about an appendix is it sounds like you stop with the story of Samson, that's the climax, and then you can go on and read the other stuff if you like. Whereas in fact, what I think we have is two stories, Judges 17 and 18 about Micah, and Judges 19 to 21 about what happened to the Levite's concubine and afterwards. Those, it's like the book is rushing onto those so that they are the climax, or rather anti-climax, of the book. They are the disastrous train wreck which is happening at the end of the book. So what I want us to do, I want us to read Judges 17 and 18, and I want us particularly to think about what this can teach us about organization and spiritual life today, and some of the mistakes that we can avoid trying as we want to build healthy organizations, healthy movements. If you get a bit confused during chapter 17, you could reflect on whether you're actually meant to get confused, because it's a mess. So let's start off with chapter 17 and 18. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke in ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I will restore it to you." So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah, And the man, Micah, had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household gods and ordained one of his sons who became his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. And he sojourned there, and the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. And as he journeyed, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I'm a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah. I am going to sojourn where I may find a place." And Micah said to him, "Stay with me and be to me a father and a priest, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year and a suit of clothing and your living." And the Levite went in, and the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. And Micah ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest." In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. For until then, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. So the people of Dan sent 5 able men from the whole number of their tribe, from Zorah and from Eshtaol, to spy out the land and to explore it. And they said to them, "Go and explore the land." And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. When they were by the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite, and they turned aside and said to him, "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What's your business here?" And he said to them, "This is how Micah dealt with me. He's hired me, and I've become his priest." And they said to him, "Inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we are setting out will succeed." And the priest said to them, "Go in peace. The Lord, the journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord." Then the 5 men departed and came to Laish and saw the people who were there, how they lived in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth and possessing wealth, and how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. And when they came to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, their brothers said to them, "What do you report?" They said, "Arise and let's go up against them for the land. And behold, it's very good. And will you do nothing? Do not be slow to go to enter in and possess the land. As soon as you go, you will come to an unsuspecting people. The land is spacious, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is in the earth." So 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons of war, set out from Zorah and Eshtaol and went up and encamped at Kiriath Jearim in Judah. And on this account, the name of the place is called Mahane Dan. To this day, behold, it's west of Kiriath Jearim. And they passed on from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Then the 5 men who had gone to scout out the country of Laish said to their brothers, "Do you know that in these houses there are an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a metal image? Now therefore, consider what you will do." And they turned aside there and came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah and asked him about his welfare. Now, the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. And the 5 men who had gone to scout out the land went up and entered and took the carved image, the ephod, and the household gods, and the metal image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. When these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household gods, and the metal image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Keep quiet. Put your hand on your mouth and come with us. And be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be a priest to the house of one man or to be the priest of the tribe and clan in Israel?" Then the priest's heart was glad. He took the ephod and the household gods and the carved image and went along with the people. So they turned and departed, putting the little ones and the livestock and the goods in front of them. When they had gone a distance from the home of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house were called out, and they overtook the people of Dan, and they shouted to the people of Dan, who turned round and said to Micah, "What's the matter with you that you come in such a company?" And he said, "You take my gods that I made and the priest and go away, and what have I left? How then do you ask me, what's the matter with you?" And the people of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry fellows fall on you, and you lose your life and the lives of your household." Then the people of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his home. But the people of Dan took what Micah had made and the priests who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. Then they rebuilt the city and lived in it, and they named the city Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor, and it was who was born to Israel. But the name of the city was Laish at first. And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Danites until the day of their captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he had made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. As you get to the end of the book of Judges, you get this chorus four times. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Sometimes you have everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And we see that people are going astray. But there's an interesting feature about when these two stories at the end of the book are set, because they are not set in chronological order. Go back to chapter 2, verse 7, and you find a remarkable thing. In chapter 2, verse 7, we read this, that the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. So the first generation they served the Lord, the next generation, but in the third generation they went astray. And what we see in this story is how this is a story set in the third generation, because it's in the days of Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses. Some of you may have, instead of Moses, Manasseh in your translation. We'll talk about that a little bit later. If we go over to the next story, the most gory story in the Bible, the story about the Levite's concubine and the injustice done to her, and then the civil war that happens after that. That happens in the town of Gibeah. Now, we've seen Bethlehem in our story. Bethlehem and Gibeah are interesting places because Gibeah is where Saul comes from and Bethlehem is where David comes from. And what we find is that that woman who is an innocent victim from Bethlehem, that woman is abused and killed. And then there is a civil war. And then we read about when these events took place in chapter 20 and verse 28. Chapter 20 and verse 28, it says, "And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, ministered before the ark in those days." So let's think about it. Aaron is the same generation as Moses. One's the lawgiver, one's the priest. One story is happening in the days of the grandson of Moses. The other story is happening in the days of the grandson of Aaron. And so what we find is how quickly people go astray. Now, we need to think a little bit more about Phinehas. What's Phinehas famous for? He's really famous for Numbers chapter 25. Numbers chapter 25, let's go back to that. Numbers chapter 25, and it's a time when you remember that Balak had tried to hire Balaam, or he had hired him, to curse Israel. That didn't work. But then there was another ploy, and this was to get the Israelites corrupted into pagan worship through the Midianite women and the Moabite women. So I want us to read Numbers chapter 25, verse 1 and 2. While Israel lived at Shittim, the people began to whore after the daughters of Moab, okay? They invited the people to the sacrifices of the gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Now, there is a scene in the middle of this where an Israelite is grabbing a Midianite woman, taking him her to his tent. And then we read about Phinehas' zeal in verse 6, seven. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose and left the congregation and took a spear in his hand and went after the man of Israel into the chamber and pierced both of them, the man of Israel and the woman, through her belly. Thus the plague of the people of Israel was stopped. And then you read about how God commends Phinehas. So Phinehas is famous for, if you like, stopping sexual misbehavior. Now, Phinehas's generation is the time when you hear this terrible story of violence by men against a woman. And where does that take place? It takes place in Gibeah. Okay, turn over to Joshua 24 and verse 33. Now, I hope you can see that God writes the Bible in such a way that it rewards you if you do cross-referencing, okay? So, and you know, God didn't put everything together in one text because actually he spreads it out, so you have to do some work, okay? So, Joshua 24, verse 33, you read this, "And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died, and they buried him at Gibeah, the town of Phinehas, his son, which had been given to him in the full hill country of Ephraim." So can you see what a disaster the book of Judges is showing? That in the very town where the guy who's so zealous against sexual misbehavior lived, that the grandson of Aaron, that's where this terrible incident in Judges chapter 19 took place. So what we've got is we've got the story in chapter 17 and 18 about idolatry, and the story in chapter 19 onwards about sexual violence. And those are the two terrible things that happen in the third generation. One connected with the lawgiver Moses, idolatry. You would have thought his name should be associated with everything against idolatry. And the other one connected with Aaron, who stands for purity. So you see why we need Jesus to come, don't you? This is what we're seeing. But there's more. Because you might be pretty fed up by the time you get to the end of the book of Judges. And by the way, both stories, chapter 17 and 18, you saw that the Levite comes from Bethlehem. Chapter 19, you see that the Levite's concubine comes from Bethlehem. Why don't we have another story from Bethlehem? Oh, what's the next book in our Bibles? It's the book of Ruth. Now, I know you like to read the genealogies, so you therefore know that you can look at the end of the book of Ruth and it will tell you about this 10-name genealogy leading from Perez to David. And of course, 30% of the names end in On, which is really cool. But in that list, there's Boaz's grandfather is Nachshon, who fathers Salmon, who fathers Boaz. Now think about it. What do we know about Nachshon? We know that Nachshon is from the generation of the Exodus because we've all read Numbers chapter 1 verse 6 that tells you he is the guy in charge of the tribe of Judah at the time. So in fact, we have three stories in a row, all set in the third generation after the Exodus, or the conquest. And you might be really fed up after the first two, and then you have this wonderful oasis in the book of Ruth, which is the exact reverse of the other two stories. Because in this story of Micah, we have the descendant of Moses leading idolatry, and in Ruth, we have the Moabites, the pagan who wouldn't be following God, saying, "Your God will be my God.
I want to turn away from idolatry to the true God. And this is amazing because of Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, isn't it? Yeah? Because what we've read there is that no Ammonite or Moabite can come into the assembly of God for 10 generations. And then we have the book of Ruth, where God, who made the rules, breaks his own rules. He's allowed to do that. And he has Ruth come in and be the ancestress of David and of Jesus. How remarkable. But there's more, because it's not just that that you have going on in the book of Ruth. You see, who were the women who were enticing the Israelites in Numbers 25? Oh, it was the Moabite women. What does a Moabite woman stand for? She stands for temptation. And then what you get in the book of Ruth, and Ruth chapter 3, is this wonderful lights off scene. You know, the lights go dark in Ruth chapter 3, where Ruth goes and she propositions Boaz at the threshing floor when he's just been drinking. Well, what's going to happen? Lights are off, man, woman. You know, well, it's a non-sex scene, right? It's a non-sex scene. It's a scene where you're expecting something to happen. And I'm going to try and demonstrate why you would expect that. Because what's a Moabite? Okay, a Moabite, what's their genealogy? It goes back to Genesis chapter 19. Okay, remember Sodom and Gomorrah, and there's Lot's family in Sodom. Angels come and say, get out. He tries to persuade his two sons-in-law to get out, and they don't, they stay. So he goes with his wife and his two virgin daughters. Wife looks back, so it's just him and his virgin daughters, which means his line is going to come to an end, okay? Two men dead, line coming to an end. And then what happens is these two daughters get their father drunk, and they procreate, okay? And that's what gives you Ammonites and Moabites. What about Boaz? What's his story? Well, that's in Genesis 38, isn't it? Because Genesis 38 is the story of Judah, who, what's going to happen to his line? Because was killed. And Onan, and you all know about him, he was killed too, right? So two guys dead, and the line's at risk of going nowhere, and Tamar takes the initiative, gets together with Judah, and from this comes the line that leads to David and leads to Jesus, right? And in each of those cases, two men dead, and then we have intergenerational sex, okay? Now, what have we got in the case of the book of Ruth? Mahlon and Chilion dead. What's going to happen to the line? Now, we've got these two representatives of their lines, haven't we? You've got Boaz and Moabite Ruth, and the lights are off. And we know they're also sort of different generations, because he calls her daughter and says, blessed are you for not going after the younger men. And then you have this glorious non-sex scene. It doesn't happen. They act nobly. And they actually, even though it is arguably a marriage with an age differential, they go ahead acting in each other's interests the whole time. So this is why the book of Ruth coming after the end of Judges is so glorious, right? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, there's one more thing I need to say, which is that you might say, well, what about the order of the books? The order of the books in the Bible can be a bit like Marvel films. Let me explain. Iron Man 2 has to come after Iron Man 1. Exodus has to come after Genesis. But not everything in the order of the books is dictated, because the technology at the time was often you'd be writing on a scroll. You might put the scroll in a jar. You have some discretion about the order, as you do if you're watching lots of Marvel films. You have some discretion about the order, but some things have to be the case. In our Bibles, there's a wonderful order intended by God that Ruth comes after Judges. But there are other orders also intended by God. If you go to a synagogue, you're probably going to find that Ruth comes after Proverbs, which is really cool because the closing scene in Proverbs 31 is the thing about the wife of noble character. And then boom, you're on to Ruth. So God has set it up even better than the creators of the Marvel Universe, much, much better, so that it all hangs together and you can be enriched. Okay, that was one of those preambles. Right, let's get on to the text. So, I'm very bad. One of the things about Judges chapter 17 is that it is sort of confusing. It begins with deja vu, doesn't it? Because it begins with a woman talking about 1,100 pieces of silver. Well, if you've been paying attention in chapter 16, you would know that's exactly the sum of money which each of the lords of the Philistines was to bring in order for Delilah to betray Samson. So she's not the same woman. It's simply a literary link. And what we have here is, first out, a confession from a son. Mum, I robbed you. Well, it's obviously bad that he robbed, but it's good that he's admitting his robbery. But the problem is the mother has cursed the thief. He admits his theft, and then she blesses him. But it's like too late when you've already cursed the thief, isn't it? And then she says, look, I'm sanctifying it all to the Lord via you. Okay, so she's going to give all the money to him. So he gives her the whole lot back. Okay, all 1,100. At which point she gets 200 and gives it to the silversmith. And there are like 900 missing. I know there's going to be a 10 silver piece wage per year. And one of the interesting things just about, bad ministries is money might go missing. Okay, and one of the things we've already got in this story is, there's quite a bit of missing money. And doesn't it seem so noble, though, that she says this? I've sanctified it to the Lord. That's great. To make a carved image, not so great. To make a molded image, really not at all great. So far, we see the characters do bad things, but also a bit of good. He confesses that he's robbed. She's dedicated stuff. She's a philanthropist, right? So it's really interesting what's going on because we're being having a story of a mess. We might want it to be worse. We might want there to be no good in the bad, right? That would be really convenient because then you can just dismiss it all. But what we've got to recognize is that there is bits of good there and lots of things being done in the name of the Lord. Verse 2, the Lord is named. Verse 3, the Lord is named. There is lots of piety going on here. So the son has cheated the mother's cheated the son, but everything's being done in God's name. And there's Micah, whose name means who's like the Lord. Then in verse 5, it gets complicated because in addition to the carved image and the molded image, there's two different ways of making images. Now we've got some household gods and an ephod, and then one of his sons, that's the grandson of the woman, becomes a priest. Then we have the chorus. In those days, there was no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Enter a new person. We have a young man from Bethlehem. And we're not told his name till the very end, okay? So all that who this young man is held back from us until chapter 18, verse 30. But we have these three stories in a row with Judges going through to Ruth about Bethlehem because the whole Bible is about Jesus. His youth is emphasized. It's not said that Micah's young, but this young man is also a Levite. But even that isn't that simple because he seems to have two passports. Now, I know sometimes people can have two passports, but normally in Israel, you don't belong to two tribes simultaneously. So we know we can have two families. Like when you get married, you can have the family of your in-laws, you can have the family you grew up with, and so on. But it's unusual. It happens in the case of Samuel as well. But here we have just a bit more confusion as this man seems to have two different tribes. He is simultaneously from Levi and from Judah. And he sets off from Ephraim. He meets Micah. And Micah says, hey, come and be a father for me. That's like be a superior, be a priest. He gets money, clothes, food, status. And that's really attractive, isn't it? Think about who are our patrons. What are we being offered? Because we could easily be corrupted through patronage. He wants a job, and now he's being offered a nice job. It's not clear whether the son of Micah is being sacked as a priest, because there are loose ends to this story, and that's fine. But the young man who's been invited to be father, it says, becomes like one of his sons. In other words, the job title that's advertised is more glamorous than the reality. Has that ever happened before? We need you to head up this new ministry. That could mean a number of different things, couldn't it? We want you to burn out doing a thankless task. Now, but he's really pleased, because now I know God's going to be with me, because I've got one of the Levites, the proper tribe for a priest. In every age, we need to watch out for syncretism, that we take Christianity and we put lots of other things around it. And one of the things what we see here is the shallowness of what's going on in terms of the links with the true faith. And that's a risk that we have at evangelicalism. That what we have is, we can easily have just a surface veneer, a superficial knowledge of the scriptures, a superficial embedding of scriptural categories in everything we do. And in that situation, we are wide open to simply merging bits of the faith with the culture of our day. We look back at missionaries of centuries before and we say, why were they so culturally insensitive? But we don't necessarily look at our own situation where we can be merging the true faith with our culture. In chapter 18, we then have this story of the tribe of Dan. Bruce Winter, who's spoken at the forum before, my predecessor at Tyndale House, said, failure has slain its thousands, and success its tens of thousands. It's very easy to think that bigger is better, and that seems to be what's going on here. Some spies are searching out the land from the tribe of Dan, and they recognize Jonathan's voice. What an extraordinary thing. Because he's from a famous family, they recognize his voice, and they ask him for guidance. And they are sounding very pious. The Danites sound pious in chapter 18, verse 5. Micah sounds pious in 18, verse 6. Lots of God talk here. And the spies continue their journey, and they find a great place to capture. Normally, the book of Judges and Joshua, they don't make you feel sorry for the people in the land, because the people in the land were wicked and they deserve to be driven out. It's the holy land that people should be driven out of if they're wicked, and Israel should be driven out of if it's wicked. That's what happens at the Babylonian exile. So, but here, I get the impression that we're meant to feel a little bit of sympathy towards these people, because Dan is going to be a tribe full of idolatry. It's not following the way of God. Well, they come along, and after the five have done their spying, they bring the whole lot of their tribe and say, do you know what? Chapter 18, verse 14, there's some great idols over in that house. And so they come along, and they're very friendly. They're friendly, but with 600 soldiers at the door. You know that? That sort of friendly, okay? And here, I'm not sure whether I'm meant to feel sympathy with a small guy idolater getting his idols stolen. At first, you see, the priest protests. He says, what are you doing taking this? And they say, do you want a promotion? Shut up and put your hand over your mouth, and why not have a promotion? Because sometimes what happens is, provided you shut up, you get a promotion. Right? There's a price. Now, he's going from one immoral job to another, but you see there, he's ambitious. That's why, being a priest for a whole tribe, that sounds rather cool, doesn't it? Anyway, the locals give chase to the people of Dan, and the people of Dan turn around and say, what's up with you guys? You've just taken my idols that I made. By the way, that's an interesting thing about idols. You make them, they don't make you. So, but he's not quite seeing, this is actually a good thing. And then they've got this tough reply. You know that we're the nice guys. You should see the guys over there. Okay? So we're treating you ever so kindly by not killing you. You never heard this sort of talk. So what you can see is just might is right. And then we have this punchline in chapter 18, verse 30, that this happened in the days of Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, or son of Moses. How many of you, by the way, have Moses in your Bibles at this point? How many of you have Manasseh in your Bibles at this point? Right, interesting, isn't it? Now, what's going on there? Hebrew's written in consonants, more Hebrew today. Moshe is three letters. Manasseh is four letters. They only differ by the letter N. And there are, in the Hebrew manuscripts, it writes M, raised N, sh, h. Okay, that's the way it does. It's got a raised letter, and there's only four times in the whole Old Testament you get a raised letter like this. It happens once every 300,000 letters, okay? Because they like quite careful about this stuff. And what that means is that the scribes had a tradition. Maybe one manuscript had read Moses, one had read Manasseh. Now, I take it that the correct understanding is Moses, because Moses had a son called Gershom, and he's from the tribe of Levi. So I think that's what's going on there. And so what we have is Jonathan is from this most famous family that's so connected with the law, and yet he's so corrupt. Why is he corrupt? He's corrupt because of his ambition, the opportunity to be promoted and then speaking piously or not speaking. There's sometimes pious speaking, sometimes there's silence, but it's not principles. He's driven on ambition. And we see both sides are very bad, just raw power at the end of the story. So what does this teach us as we think about building healthy movements and organizations? Well, firstly, doctrine matters. It's really important we get things right. There's one God, and we need to know the scriptures, and we need to be avoiding idolatry. But also we need to see through pious words. You see, a lot of time people can use God talk to hide stuff. There was a commission in the Church of England with a wonderful title, Living in Love and Faith. Doesn't that sound good? You know, but actually what it can be is an excuse for diluting biblical morality. So we need to be able to see through pious words. That is so important. And we need to see through that in evangelical subculture as well. Don't let's say, oh, we see through the liberals' pious words. Let's start seeing through our own pious language. Because I think we can do quite a bit of that. And so we start with ourselves. You know, don't point fingers at others first. We need to look at how much are we doing that. And then think about the hidden power structures that we have. It's interesting that we have in this story a senior person, Micah, promoting a junior person. Often that happens, that what happens is the senior abusive person finds younger people that they can manipulate. And then we have the whole question of funding. Who's paying for this? I mean, I'm involved leading a charity. You have to look very carefully at your patronage. And then how much am I looking for personal comfort like this priest was? What accountability do I have? What are my personal ambitions? What are our corporate ambitions? As one person said to me, a very wise person, don't let your vision become your idol. That easily you can have such ambitions, which are sort of for God, but quite a bit for your ego as well, you know, and you drive yourself to this and you lose integrity. Beware of alignment with power. Christianity is at its purest when it's not aligned with power. Now, that's a difficult thing because, I mean, obviously there are amazing things going on in Europe at the moment. We're seeing an upturn in church attendance and people coming to faith in the UK. But what happened is we may, at some stage in the future, be offered a more Christian Europe, which, given the alternatives, could be a very good thing. But what comes under the label Christian? You know, your Let's Return to Christendom political party may look a lot sweeter than the Let's Go On to Islamism political party, or Let's Have a Secular Festival political party, right? But what gets tied up in those things when you start looking deeply? What are the hidden power structures? What compromises might you need to make? And so all of this, of course, points us to Christ. Because Christ is the only one who is completely pure. He has open proclamation. He has no hidden motives. And he's not in anyone's pocket. In fact, he gave up the wealth of heaven to come to earth for us. And he went alone to the cross, appreciated by no one. What an amazing thing. Are we being offered things today, influenced through compromise, or just pursuing the course of our own comfort? Is the purity of the gospel there? Jonathan, in this story, got himself a great job, but it was disastrous for Israel. Dan became the only tribe which is not mentioned in the book of Revelation, in that list of all of the tribes, say, because idolatry excludes you from the kingdom of God. Many of us may receive great offers in the future, but we need to remember Christ, that his path was the difficult one, and he chose it, and he bought our redemption, and he gave the best possible hope for Europe. We can dwell on Micah's mess, or we can flick over the pages and have the comfort of the book of Ruth. Think about that. This woman, excluded from the generations of God, and yet by grace incorporated. You see, one of the things we realize from this is that genealogy is not destiny. Jonathan had a really good genealogy. Moses as his grandfather. What was Ruth's genealogy? Nothing, but she gets to be the ancestress of Jesus Christ, our Savior. What an amazing thing. The path of idolatry that comes from privilege and all of that inheritance that Jonathan the idolater had, or this sacrificial love that Ruth showed as she just clung to Naomi and said, I'm not going to leave you. I'm going to follow your God. Your God will be my God. I'll die, be buried where you're buried. What an amazing thing. And it's that that God rewards and God brought into the redemption line that leads to Jesus. So what does that mean for us? Well, let's think about our privilege, what we might be taking for granted. But let's realize that whatever our different situations and however far and weak we may feel from God, however weak we are, God wants to have us and use us for plans that are bigger than we can imagine. So let's not take the path of idolatry and privilege. Let's take the path of Ruth and the path of our Lord Jesus Christ.